Opal said. Kern's probably thin as a toothpick from starving. The deputy didn't talk on the ride back into town. He knew better than to bother the sheriff when Opal was thinking like this. It wasn't even the right time to bring up something nice. It was time to let Sheriff Opal work. Carol carried. Dwight had carried her to the coach. Carol heard every grunt, every heavy step, every creak on the way. But more important, she saw it. The light had not been put out. As Dwight took her from the slab, Carol wasn't sure which she feared more, losing the light, or it somehow coming with her. Dwight was taking her somewhere new. Where? The graveyard? Was this it? Her burial? She did not cry for help. Instead, she did something she had never done. Carol sat up in Howltown. Whether or not this action was replicable, possible, in the real world, Carol did not yet know. But the act of rising, even half-rising, was a triumph. Oh, how she wanted to tell John Bowie! Oh, how she wanted Hattie to know! Mom! Mom, I sat up! By no accident or lucky mistake, I sat up! And yet, the monster had made a mistake. The monster had rolled her over, turning her wholly toward the direction from which she had fallen. And for the first time ever inside the coma, Carol held out hope that she might have some control in the coma. Sitting up proved as much. It happened as the image of the storm room was strangely replaced with the image of the cellar at large, as if Carol were looking through a photo album, a book of pictures too fine for even the most affluent Harrisers. Yes, in the light that still shone inside the coma, the light the monster no doubt left for her, the storm room became the cellar, then the cellar stairs. From there, Carol saw still images of the kitchen, a hall, the dining room, the parlor, the foyer, the front door. All flipped, it seemed, by unseen hands. She did not see Dwight, who carried her, and so the moments played out as if Carol were a ghost floating through the very house she owned. Dwight's voice came from far away, deep within the clacking of his shoes upon the kitchen floor, steps like falling rocks in Howltown.
"Hide your lady," he said. "Hide her, I am."
By the time he'd carried her out the front door, he was breathing hard. Carol saw a still image of the coach in the drive, then a similar image, but with the coach door open. Then she was inside it, sitting up, on the floor, and yet not sitting up, too. The Carol whom Dwight hid lay as deathlike upon her back as she had in the storm room. But while the sense of unfathomable progress, sitting up in Howltown, waged war with the horrors of betrayal and electrified nerves, Carol's senses of place and time were confused even more so by the image she saw inside the coach. The image of herself, still on her back. She saw her own eyes closed, her hair splayed across her forehead, the same yellow dress and brown boots she'd worn while walking with Farah in the garden. Carol stared long at her own image, as Dwight snapped the reins and the horse hooves erupted like a stone avalanche in Howltown. A mirror, she thought. Dwight had placed a mirror inside the coach with her. He'd set it on the floor, facing her, as if he'd wanted her to see that, despite her incredible achievement, she was actually no better off than she was before the monster made his mistake in the storm room. But Dwight couldn't have known about that. And the mirror frightened her, not only because of what it showed her, but because it meant Dwight had plans. And what might they be?
"Hide your lady!"
Dwight called, and his voice was the muddy crest of a freshly dug grave.
"And hide her I am!"
Carol looked to her sleeping form in the mirror. She recognized it as a mirror John Bowie had brought to the house one evening, what he studiously described as
the kind of mirror you set up in the middle of the room. It reflects on both sides. That way you can see yourself no matter where you are. And if you were to fall in its presence, who knows, maybe watching yourself fall might help.
Dwight didn't know John had gotten it for her. Nor would he have cared. Yet despite the helpful gift John had presented it as, Dwight was now using it for some means Carol could not guess at. And the anger she felt at her husband for using anything John Bowie had given her at all gave her a deeper strength.
one she badly needed. She looked to her hands in the glass. She concentrated on her fingers. The Carol who was sitting up watched the Carol inert on the floor of the coach. And as she tried to move her fingers, as Dwight directed the horses toward the unknown, Carol's unknown, she succeeded in lifting her fingers, her physical fingers, slightly, from the coach floor, then, momentarily defeated, let them fall limp again. Then she heard the crazed sound of many hoarse voices, many throats erupting into laughter, like the many faces that appeared and then vanished in the impossible candlelight of the storm room. Light or no light, Carol was still in Howltown, and no glimpse of herself in the real world was going to get her out. Edward Bunny. Edward Bunny was playing cards in a saloon in Portsmouth when the man named Hickory came through the swivel doors. Edward knew his face well. Hickory was an outlaw liaison, a man with news. When he showed up, it meant he had something to tell you. Edward Bunny himself was a trail watcher. Triggermen were hired every day. Outlaws ran rampant. Bunny kept track of them all. To some men, it was very important to know where the killers on the trail were at any given point in time. None of the guns had permanent homes. Hardly any of them went by real names. Bunny's job was to track them, report where they were, hire them out, then report on the status of their job. A common hiring of Edward Bunny went as so. Bunny would receive a telegram asking, "Who is near?" and Bunny would respond with a couple of names. Another telegram would come asking, "Who was best for the job?" Not meaning that Bunny knew the details of the hit, but rather that he knew which assassins were sober, stable, and capable at the time of the communication. It was an important job, the hub of a dark wheel. Bunny had no boss, but was contacted often by Lafayette up in Harrow's, and men and women like her in every town on the trail. The man Hickory, leaning against the bar now, doing a bad job feigning indifference, meant that it was Lafayette calling indeed. None of the hitmen particularly liked Edward Bunny. Nobody liked to be followed, and who knew how he picked who was sober and who wasn't. For this, Bunny often faced death. A barrel between his eyes, a tavern full of mad, drunk crooks. Even the whores disliked him. And yet Bunny put real money in their pockets. If Bunny contacted a trigger man, the man knew he was getting paid well for something that might take him less than 4 days to carry out. Most lawmen knew who Bunny was, but there was nothing in the county laws to lynch a man for speaking with another, and Bunny had no blood on his hands. In fact, Edward Bunny had never killed a man in his life. But he'd orchestrated the deaths of 100. His intricate system of trail watching consisted of a deck of playing cards sewn into his brown jacket pocket. The cards represented the individual hitmen and outlaws of the trail. Sam Jordan was the Jack of Knives, Howard Bone Axe Freely, the Nine of Darts, Paula Hughes from Kellytown, the Six of Bullets, and so on. The way the cards were stacked corresponded with the towns of the trail. If Freely was in, say, Mackatoon, his card would be on the very bottom of the deck, Mackatoon being the southernmost trail town. If Marla Morgan was in Harrow's, hers would be on the top, Harrow's being the trail's northern peak. There were no names on these cards, no faces, no notes. But Bunny knew them very well. And the clever lawman, who cut open the secret pocket in his jacket, found nothing but a shuffled deck of cards, a meaningless possession, and certainly nothing to lock a man up over. Today, Bunny was making a couple of outlaws some money in a different way. He was terrible at playing cards. "Bunny," Otis Parlin said, his voice rough with smoke, "you gotta practice." Bunny, shaking his head, his thin hair barely covering his round skull, did not respond. Behind his small, thick glasses, he glared once at Parlin's and motioned for another hand. As Bernie Garland shuffled, Bunny watched Hickory at the bar. His eyes were on the cards on the table, but he paid attention to the leaning shape, doing his customary awful job of trying to hide the fact he was here for business. In all his life, Bunny had never known a more obvious informant.
"Bunny,"
Lawrence Buchanan said, raising his glass.
"A drink, on me, with your money."
The outlaws broke into laughter, and the bartender looked over to the quartet with concern.
For a moment, Bunny and Hickory locked eyes. Then Bunny took hold of his cards.
"Lawrence," Bunny said, thinking of the seven of darts that represented Buchanan in his pocket. "I don't drink."
There was a moment of bad silence. It was just another reason to dislike Edward Bunny. The man never drank, never got drunk. The hand went around and Bunny raised, and all the outlaws met him, because Edward Bunny hardly ever won. Behind his glasses, Bunny's eyes sparkled, and his round face broke into a slight child's smile. At the bar, Hickory looked to Bunny, and then pretended he hadn't, shoving a handful of peanuts into his mouth. The bartender watched him and shook his head, knowing well what Hickory was doing in his tavern, and who he was here to see.
"Bunny," Farlin said, "you wouldn't be holding something good now, would you? You look like you done got ass to the ball."
Bunny, sweating beneath his vest, glanced at Otis, but did not respond. Then Bunny raised again, and now the three crooks could feel the growing pile of money in their own pockets. When Edward Bunny asked you to play cards, you took him up on it. No other man on the trail had such a delusional image of himself as a card player.
"High stakes, Bunny. Getting serious, Bunny.
Must have all 52 in that hand, Bunny."
Bunny started tapping a small black shoe on the tavern's wood floor. The men had seen him this way before. Drinks or no drinks, Bunny played like a drunk.
"We're all still in, Bunny," Buchanan said. "What are you going to do?"
Bunny stared at his hand in silence. Then he reached into his vest, pulled forth more money, and set it on the table. The men joked, but Bunny could hear in their voices they were starting to believe him. Parlin said,
"You're a hard man to read, Bunny,"
and set his cards down.
"That's a pretty pile of coin," Bernie Garland said. "It's going to look very nice in my vest."
At the bar, Hickory ordered another drink and then coughed for Bunny to hear. Without looking at him, Bunny shook his head. Hickory was about as well hidden as a sheriff's badge.
"How about a drink?"
Garland asked Bunny, smiling.
"I don't drink, Bernie."
Bunny raised again, and Buchanan folded without comment. Bunny looked to Garland, who looked down at his cards. Hickory tapped his fingers on the wood bar, and it sounded like a clock ticking.
"Now, Bunny," Garland said, wiping his forehead with the back of his hand, "you've got me thinking."
Bunny laughed, a single high-pitched clap, and the bartender turned his head. At the bar, Hickory made a slight moaning sound. Bunny raised once more, and then so did Garland, and the men put their cards down. Bunny turned his over like an excited child, his thin hair wet on his head, his glasses reflecting the cards on the table. His mouth smiled, but his eyes did not, and Garland shook his head as Bunny made sense of the cards.
"Bunny," Garland said, "I done told you that pie was gonna look nice on my mantle."
There was a moment of silence before Bunny slammed his fist hard on the table and pointed a finger at Garland and shook it. His face was tomato red. Then Hickory coughed again, and Bunny, breathing hard, flattened his hair to his head, adjusted his glasses, and said,
"Nice playing with you gentlemen."
He took his brown suit jacket from the back of his chair and walked to the bar. Hickory stood half a foot taller than the trail watcher.
"What is it?"
Bunny asked.
"Smoke."
Bunny did not respond.
"You want a drink, Bunny?"
"I don't drink."
"He's following James Moxie."
"I know that, you idiot."
"Hey, Bunny, I'm just..."
"When we do this, Hickory, when you come in here and I come over here, and we get to talking about the things we talk about, just give me the facts and move on, understand? You think I don't know where Smoke and Moxie are?"
No, sir, Bunny,
none of this chit-chat, no explanations, understand?"
"Hey, ease up, Bunny."
The bartender approached, and Bunny glared at him, and he turned away again.
"She just wants a report, Bunny. Lafayette just wants..."
But Hickory stopped talking, because Bunny was staring at him like he was going to slap him.
"You know what to do, Bunny,"
Hickory said. Then he downed his whiskey and nodded and left the tavern. Bunny sat at the bar. The bartender brought him a lemonade. Smoke. Bunny knew Smoke was the craziest pig shitter on the trail. Most hitmen were afraid of him. Nobody liked talking to him. It was impossible to have anything like a conversation with the man. In his deck, Smoke was the Two of Storms.
Two for the two tin legs, storms for the darkness surrounding the crazed, hatless Triggerman. James Moxie was the king of bullets. Bunny liked the irony, a man becoming king of bullets for not firing his gun. The picture cards were reserved for the big names, and though it had been 9 years since James Moxie rode the trail, his was a hard name to lessen. But while the trick in Aberystown might have been the greatest feat the trail had ever known, James Moxie didn't have the teeth some of the others did. There was something soft about him to Bunny, and yet his name still chilled. Mystery, or mysticism. Magic. That king of bullets had sat on the bottom of his deck for a very long time. Lately it had been moving up toward Harrow's, and the two of storms had been following, some 10 cards away still, but certainly closing in. Bunny laughed and downed the lemonade. In a way, he was the boss of these terrible men. All of them knew him, all of them so tough. Yet not one would like the job of following Smoke on the trail. Smoke had some stories, and Bunny had heard them all. He wiped his mouth with a napkin from the bar. He felt for the deck of cards in the pocket of his brown jacket, then slipped the jacket on and walked to the table where the three outlaws still drank.
"Bunny," Bernie Garland said, "you look like you got something funny on your mind."
Bunny glared at them, these three. Sometimes outlaws didn't like being watched. Smoke surely wouldn't. But these bastards needed babysitting. Why, if a man like Edward Bunny wasn't around, the trail would be mad carnage chaos, and only the law would see any of the money.
"What is it, Bunny?"
Bunny just stared at them, sweat dripping down his cheeks. Then his mouth smiled, and his eyes did not, and his black shoes clacked on the tavern's wood floor as he exited through the saloon doors. The sun was out in Portsooth, but not very high. Smoke was near. Bunny knew this because Bunny knew more about these pig-shitters than any of them wanted him to. He headed up Portsooth Street, thinking of the gradual climbing of the slow-moving Two of Storms and that long-slumbering King of Bullets. As the sun made waxy his sweating face, Bunny could practically feel the pair moving in his pocket. Lafayette wasn't the only one who wanted to see to it that they collided. Opal and Farah. Farah hadn't stopped drinking since finding Carol on the slab in the cellar. Clyde was doing all he could to calm her, to help her, but the only thing that was making any progress was a series of bottles. And yet she wasn't drunk, not entirely. As if the horror of seeing her lady die and the confusion of seeing her so lifelike in the storm room refused to be washed away. She stepped out of the general store, a fresh bottle of whiskey in hand, and saw Sheriff Opal rise from a bench along the boardwalk.
"Evening, Mrs. Darrow."
Farah acknowledged the lawman and stepped by him. The name Dwight Evers burst in her mind and fizzled. She wondered if Opal had somehow kept tabs on how much she'd drunk. But there was no law against drowning yourself.
"Mrs. Darrow, you mind having a word with me?"
Farah turned clumsily. Seeing her now, the sun full upon her features, the sheriff could tell the girl had been drinking indeed. But more than that, she'd been crying. A lot.
"I'd no idea you were wanting to talk to me, Sheriff Opal. I do apologize."
Harrowsers passed on the planks of the boardwalks, as if Carol Evers had never died. As if everybody was kept cold in the cellar of a home with warm rooms. Opal removed his hat.
"Let's find ourselves some privacy, Farah."
She walked with the lawman to the end of the boardwalk and turned down a quiet, wooded side road. Opal was careful to present himself gently.
"I understand you had quite a relationship with Mrs. Evers, Farah, and I'm awful sorry things have come to pass as they have."
Farah stared long into the sheriff's eyes. A small flame sparked inside her, a flicker, it seemed, of hope. Sheriff Opal wanted to talk about Carol.
"I'm not sure what I want to ask you, young lady. There are a number of questions on my mind."
"Ask me anything, please."
He watched the girl a moment before continuing.
"Did you see Mrs. Evers the night she died?"
"I was with her when she collapsed."
"That right?"
"That it is. We'd been walking through the garden. She didn't seem well."
"Didn't seem well how?"
She said she didn't feel well.
Opal nodded.
Did she explain that any further?
I think she was about to, Sheriff. She wanted to tell me something just before she fell. She hinted at a pre-existing condition.
What did she say? How'd she put it?
Farrah sighed. Her eyes were wet with more tears to come. She shivered at the thought of Dwight asking her the same questions.
She told me she had a sickness, said it didn't come off, and that she could see it when it did.
Opal frowned.
Do you know what she was referring to?
No, sir. I'm sorry, but I don't.
Opal nodded. He studied Farrah's face and felt sorry for her. He'd seen her many times in town, and this version of her was the wrong one.
Farrah, I only ask you these questions because it's my job around town to understand what's happened to anyone living in Harrow's. It's about safety, protection.
Of course. But surely you feel something is wrong for you to be asking questions.
Opal paused. There was hope in her voice.
Do you think something's wrong, Farrah?
I don't know. Maybe.
You see, that answer frightens me.
Now the tears did come, quietly falling gently down her face. Then Opal said,
I've never been very good at hiding where I'm going. Used to be people told me I'd never make it in the law business because I wasn't clever enough. I'm interested to know about you finding Mrs. Evers in the storm room.
Farrah's eyes widened.
How did you know about that?
Opal did not smile when he answered.
I'm not sure myself, but I heard it. I did.
Farrah imagined Clyde, drunk, running his mouth at a tavern. She would have words with him later. Or maybe not. Maybe this time Clyde had given her a gift. Then she told Opal the same story she told Clyde the morning after she found Carol. That Dwight was very serious about discovering what Mrs. Evers told her before dying. How she fainted, woke up alone in the house, and found her lady in the cellar. Opal listened closely.
How long were you asleep for?
I don't know.
Can you try to figure it out for me? It might mean a lot.
Farrah brought a hand to her forehead. The phrase a lot frightened her. She worked through it with the sheriff. The sun was not yet fully down when she fainted.
When I came to, it was dark, but the sun was showing by the time I got home.
Opal nodded. Girl's got a bad feeling, too, he thought. First the minister of death, now the dead lady's girl.
Any idea where she is now, Farrah?
Carol?
Yes.
I don't know. The cellar still? I don't know.
Opal nodded. He didn't want to tell he'd been down there.
Let's talk a moment more. A couple more questions, if I may.
Of course.
She gripped the whiskey bottle tight. A man passed and tipped his cap to Opal. Opal waited for him to be gone.
How did Mr. Evers look to you when he learned the reason you screamed?
Farrah held his eyes and answered,
He wanted to know what she almost told me, Sheriff.
Sure, his wife collapsed after all. But what I mean to ask is, did you notice anything beyond grief?
Farrah looked confused, and yet eager.
I'm not sure I understand.
Sure, I wouldn't expect you to.
But...
But what now?
Farrah breathed deep.
Before she fell, before our walk in the garden, I overheard the two of them arguing.
Uh-huh, arguing.
And Carol was telling Mr. Evers something about the next time it happens and someone else needs to know, something like that.
The next time what happens?
I don't know.
Is that all?
No.
Uh-huh.
She also told Mr. Evers that it was time to let me in.
Let who in?
Me.
Into what? Any idea?
None, sir.
Opal nodded. He made to speak, but Farrah cut him off.
I don't mean to accuse, but Mr. Evers really was intent on finding something out.
Farrah's eyes were red with it.
I don't know what it means. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said as much.
Opal nodded, studying the girl's face, noting how dry her face looked, despite her tears, as if her skin was flaking with her lady's, as if she'd cried and dried up 6 times today already.
I'm not asking you to accuse Farah, but the way I like to work is to get a feel for things. You see, once I had a man come to me and tell me his brother had a terrible accident with a shovel. I listened to him, but then I got to thinking that the words he used to describe his brother weren't the kindest words a man ever used. I egged this side of him on a bit, you see, and sure enough, turned out the man had done his own brother in and was looking to cover it up. You here just sort of said something that caught my ear, so you worrying about accusing someone makes me think you had the thought yourself. And you never can tell when one of those silly old thoughts ends up being nothing other than the truth. They're worth checking, I'd say. Farah looked up and down the street now.
I'm not sure what I meant.
But not defeated. She had hope yet.
Sure, sure, Opal said, reassuring her. The cellar.
I'm sorry?
You were in the cellar, and I apologize in advance for making you do this once more, but you saw your lady there in the storm room. You touched her. You asked her to wake, and...
And I've already told you, I...
And something crossed your mind.
Farah shook her head, the gesture of a woman who discovered she was going to do something she wasn't sure she wanted to.
I thought Mr. Evers might have done something to her.
Opal nodded, his eyes on hers.
I imagine their cellar is as cold as any.
Colder, sir.
Farah looked to the dirt at their feet.
Well, look now, Opal said, planting both his big hands on his hips.
Farah noticed how close his hands were to his guns, as if, because of what she'd told him, danger was coming.
You and I have had ourselves a real hog of a conversation here. Don't think I missed it, that it's been suggested Mr. Evers might have done something terrible, suggested by someone who spends more time with him than I do. But truth is, we don't know that he has, and chances are very high he hasn't. In all my years in law, I've only encountered a couple of men who did something as wrong as killing their own wife. Thing is, too many edges aren't squaring off. Then maybe I shouldn't be saying as much to a young lady like yourself, but as it goes, I got a feeling, and my feeling about you is that you could help me. Maybe you already have. Maybe you're about to. But let's not part ways today with worry on our minds. Most likely, we should be grieving the loss of a wonderful lady. Sometimes in such matters, someone does something a bit out of the ordinary, and everyone gets uneasy, pointing fingers and saying this or that can't be right because this or that was done wrong. Mr. Evers is most likely dealing with the loss of his wife. Can we blame him if he acts any different than he normally would? I'd say not. And I say it's a much more suspicious thing if he did, but you and me, we ought to keep our heads and... Let me look further into things, and hopefully I come knocking on your door and tell you that it was just plain old justified sadness that got the better of us today and made us think such wretched thoughts.
Farah thought, we've got to do something. Then she thought of the telegram she sent to James Moxie, the news of Carol's death. She wiped her face with her arm.
All right, Sheriff.
Let me ask you something before I let you go. You ever meet an Alexander Wolfe, friend of Mr. Evers?
Farah tried to remember.
There have been many people to the house since I started there.
For parties and such?
Yes, gatherings.
Uh-huh. But no Alexander Wolfe? Alex, maybe? From west of Harrow's? From Charles?
Farah shook her head like she'd disappointed the sheriff.
That's all right, he said. How about Mr. Evers' family? You ever meet anybody in the same line of work as Mr. Manders over there?
Is that what he said?
Is that what who said?
Mr. Evers.
Farah reddened.
Did he say he'd gotten his family to take care of her?
He did indeed.
Farah shook her head no, a definitive no. She'd never met anybody else in her life in Manders' line of work.
Well, all right, Opal said.
He put his hat back upon his head and smiled in a fatherly way.
I thank you, and I thank you again for taking the time with me. And if you remember anything else...
Of course.
But don't sit around trying to remember things all day, neither. That'll just rip you in half. You can trust me there.
He studied her sad face a moment longer and said,
If anything funny is going on, I'll find out what it is. You can rest with that as a pillow.
Smoke close. Jefferson had just finished writing when the knocking came. At first he thought it was his old friend again, come back for one more memory. But Jefferson was no fool to the ways of the chase. He peered out the window. Through the blanket, he couldn't tell if the hatless man was crippled or not. He was standing still, his hands in his pockets, looking down at the dirt, and there was no horse looped in the yard.
"I know you're home,"
the stranger called, and Jefferson could tell a bad man when he saw one. Worse, this man, whoever he was, crippled or not, was crazy. You could see it clear as canvas in his eyes. Jefferson watched for a long time before slinking back along the wall. Hunched, he hurried to where a shotgun hung by string above a bookshelf. He untied it and took it down.
"I can hear you in there."
Jefferson gripped the barrel and hunched to the kitchen table. Above it was another shelf, stabilized by string, and on it were the shells. He set the gun on the table and grimaced as he tried, unable to reach them.
"I've had a bit of an accident," Smoke called. "My coach fell to bits from that hole out on the trail. I could sure use some assistance."
Jefferson pulled a chair over to the shelf. Taking hold of the chair back, he lifted himself up.
"I won't be long. You just let me know if you can help and where I can get help if you can't."
Up on the chair, Jefferson took hold of the shells and had difficulty getting back down. Smoke continued.
"You don't need to open the door. Just let me know where I can get some help."
Jefferson opened the chamber and thumbed the shells inside.
"I know you're in there. Don't make it so I come in on my own."
Jefferson braced himself with the nearest chair and hunched past the table. He limped across the room, lifted the gun, and shot a hole through the door. Wood splinters exploded.
"Ain't coming in on your own now,"
Jefferson yelled. He hunched to the door and looked through the break. It was hard to see whether or not the man lay dead on his stoop. Jefferson, sweating, hunched to the window and pulled back the blankets and saw the man wasn't there at all.
"Hell's heaven."
No body, no blood. Jefferson limped to the other side of the old schoolhouse, kicking yellowed pages out of the way. He looked out the window. The man was in the backyard, making a pile of his things. Jefferson didn't need the confirmation now, but he saw the man was crippled.
"Tell me what you gave him,"
Smoke yelled, tossing another book on the pile. Jefferson hunched back to the kitchen table and reloaded. Sweat dripped from his chin. It felt incredible in its way. Action. He held the gun tight, as if gripping his own entire history on the trail. At the window again, he used the barrel to push aside the drapes and knocked on the glass with it.
"You about ready for hell's heaven, kid?"
Smoke kept his eyes on the pile when he responded.
"I know he didn't stop by for supper." "Nobody stopped by at all, cripple. What did he need, hermit? Just tell me what he took."
Smoke took a birdhouse from a maple tree and tossed it onto the heap. The wood split when it landed. Cracked eggs half rolled forth. Jefferson knocked on the window again. Smoke looked up. Jefferson fired through the glass. When the smoke and glass cleared, he saw the man had been hit. He'd shot him in the shin.
"I'm aiming for your chest next, kid."
Smoke looked down. Oil spilled fast. His pant leg and boot were black with it. He'd been hit high, just under the knee. The serrated tin already dug into his flesh.
"Come on out here and shoot a cripple to his face, hermit."
Jefferson howled with delight. Moxie was right. It felt good. He slunk back against the wall out of view and reloaded the gun. When he came back, Smoke was adding to the pile.
"You're a thirsty one, cripple. Ready to drink your own blood, you are."
He fired again. A tree to Smoke's right cracked thunder. Smoke pulled a small box from his pocket and removed a match. It came to life between his fingers, and he let it fall to the oil below.
Whoomp!
The pile took flight. Jefferson howled as he watched his things go aflame. He reloaded the gun quickly and limped to the door. He could hear his things burning, crackling,
the horror of all hoarders. His shoulder against the front door, he staggered out of the schoolhouse.
You'll be about ready to die, cripple. It's coming now.
Fresh pain gripped his back, pincers along the spine. When he rounded the schoolhouse, gun held high, he saw the cripple was facing him. The cockiness that graced the trigger man's face was no longer there. In its stead was rage. Jefferson was only 20 feet from him, but smoke didn't move. Jefferson saw a second match come to life. He watched it fall. Whoomp! Boom! Moxie's old riding partner saw it coming, but didn't understand what it was. He hadn't seen Smoke's hands in his pockets when he rounded the house himself. He hadn't seen when Smoke laid bare a path of oil thick enough to trap a horse. The flames rose like a living wall and got to Jefferson before his debilitating back would let him get out of the way. Smoke watched him burn. Jefferson's body contorted strangely as he fell to his knees, as if, in death, the old outlaw was more mobile after all. The flames rendered him like the blackened yard tools on the burnt grass. Smoke didn't move. He didn't speak. He watched. When it was over, Smoke limped around the schoolhouse and kicked in the front door. Oil splashed against the open cut on his knee. He looked inside. All he saw was books, and all he saw was paper. All he saw was a burn to be. The hermit had shot him in the shin. The hermit was ashes on the grass.
All you had to do was tell me!
Smoke screamed, knocking things from the table.
All you had to do was tell me what the old man stopped by for.
Sweating, he turned around and saw the writings on the walls. He grabbed a mug from a counter.
I'm gonna burn it all, hermit. Burn every pig-shitting word.
Books, papers, pages. Smoke burned it all. The hermit was dead, and the outlaw was getting closer to Harrow's, but for one magnificent moment, Smoke just needed to burn. By the time he was done, the words on the walls had melted into unintelligible marks, symbols, nonsense. Black smudges like the writings of a blind madman. And all the hermit had to do was tell him what the outlaw came for.
Could have saved your life, pig shitter.
But all Smoke had to do was look up, and he would have seen what gift Moxie had received. Jefferson had just finished writing about Aberystown when Smoke knocked on the door. Aberystown.
The people in West Franklinville don't tell it right. The people in Juniper don't tell it right. The people in Mackatoon don't really know the truth about it, and the ones who do don't tell it right neither. Some say James Moxie dropped 6 men with 1 shot. Others say he breathed fire. Even the ones who was there, the crowd that started all the talking in the first place, even they don't get it right. 'Cause that's how easy it is once a legend begins. Moxie done his thing with mayhaps 2 dozen watchers, but a story like his travels quick. It's got to, 'cause it done pop up so much in their memories that they gotta tell the nearest person, or they're liable to implode. What's more interesting, anyway? Men talk fishing, men talk women, men talk cards. But shudders aplenty if bearing witness to a magnificent move don't trump them all. Imagine yourself sitting on a stool, drinking good beer, and the fella next to you starts off about how his crop ain't coming up like it oughta, and how it'd sure be nice if some rain would drop, and how fertile and wonderful his dirt usually is. And here you are listening, but bubbling over with that story your own. Not so much wanting to beat his, but wanting to hear something better than this. And you know the scene you witnessed is just about as exciting as it gets. Why, after some time you'd tell it. You'd have to, 'cause in the landscape we all live in, the outlaw can be artist. The outlaw can be entertainment. Lest he be the black soul kind that kills for sport, the outlaw is the man men can get together o'er. The outlaw is the man made of stories. And some people say it was a trick. I know Moxie would say the same himself, but you can't go on the word of the man who done it. I've heard people call it cheap, and I've argued with those people. It's not a fair fight, some say, no matter what he done. I asked them what was unfair about it. Some answer they don't know, and others say, Well, if magic were used and both men don't know magic, then it ain't a fair fight. I laugh and say, well, what if guns are used and one of the men don't know how to use guns? The outlaw's object isn't always fairness. In fact, the outlaw's object is usually whatever he came there to get. And Frank Tilly robbed a bank in Bully by dressing up as the manager after noticing he looked an awful lot like the man. Some people say that's not a fair fight. They say Tilly ought to have come in and held the place up and made the tellers put the coin in a bag and seen if he could outrun the law through the streets of Bully. As it stood, Tilly left at lunchtime through a back door, a sleeping sack loaded with coin. He was discovered in Harrow's, living like a prince. People don't like that no chase was involved. People don't like that no guns were drawn. But I say, that's as clean a pile of pig shit as any I ever stepped in. Tilly used his brain. And hell's heaven if his story ain't a good one to tell. Now, Moxie was something different altogether. Moxie's story scared some. People don't like magic when it's black, and nobody could figure out any other way to title what he'd done. I rode out of Aberystown with Moxie after he did it, and it was the last ride he took as an anonymous. Next time we saw others after, people inched their way to ask him how he'd done it. And when Moxie turned to face them, you saw fear fill their own. What if he does it to me? They were thinking. What if he drops me right now without drawing a gun? What people don't know is why Moxie was facing Daniel Prouds in the first place. And don't you know that's the least interesting color of the yarn? But it helps shed light, 'cause once you get the idea that Prouds was a sack of pig shit, you don't care about fair fights or the rules of engagement, and all you want to hear is how someone like Moxie came in and skinned the swine. Down in Pruittville, a man tells me James Moxie wasn't a good outlaw 'cause he didn't kill enough to count. I told him I was under the impression Moxie Dunn lived off his outlawing for some 11 years, and if that ain't good work, you've got your facts twisted. He said I was right, but then he said magic doesn't count. I laughed then, and I laugh now. Magic most certainly counts. And in the case of James Moxie and Daniel Prouds, magic happened, though I know it weren't the type that man and most men imply. The magic is in Moxie's brain, 'cause the idea to do what he'd done didn't exist until it did. Presto. And how do you explain that? Moxie and I were on a cross-country crime spree when our horses stepped over the Aberystown border. Ignorant as it was, we saw ourselves as vigilantes, spirit riders on the trail who put it good to the pig shitters of the world. I'm not saying we were the good guys, but there's no question in whether or not James Moxie and myself were on the opposite side of the coin as that throat-slitter shitter Daniel Prouds. Nobody knew our names yet in them days, and we used them freely. Down the road, Moxie would have to pretend to be someone he wasn't, and I think all that got to him, 'cause he stopped wanting to talk about it. But when we first crossed into Aberystown, I introduced myself as Jefferson, and James introduced himself as James. The town was even more alive then than it is now, and we rode Main Street with fire in our hearts, for we knew we weren't getting out of there without some fun. You can tell with the bigger towns. Albertsport and Donner ain't no fun. Neither is Kellytown. Never had no fun in any of them places. But Griggsville, Harrow's too, and most definitely Aberystown. Now, these are the places a man beneath the law can scoop something up nobody else noticed, 'cause everybody else was busy scooping their own. I laugh now remembering Moxie tipping his hat to a lawman who passed us upon entering. He done tipped his hat and said, "Afternoon, officer," before muttering, "You're gonna come looking for us later," under his breath. We were an exciting duo, the sort of fellas outlaws could recognize at a glance, not because we were wanted, though we were, but because like kind recognizes like kind, like vampires understand, or drunks. An outlaw can see himself reflected in the eyes of another, no matter how black or gray his heart may be. We seen a couple upon entering, and they seen us, men outside the tavern, men at the hitching post out front of the bawdy house. But neither of us saw Daniel Prouds until we started to drinking at a place they used to call Leonard's Barn Burner, 'cause his theme was fire, and his ladies set drinks aflame. Back then, I brought some books with me on the trail, There were a heap of lonely nights by the fire, understand, and I defy anyone to name a man I rode with who didn't eventually ask me what went on inside them. Now, I don't recall the exact volumes I had on me, but I carried them with me into Leonard's lest a rapscallion come nab them from a horse. I've no way of knowing that a routine gesture like that, just bringing in my books, would spark the single most interesting moment in outlawing history thus far. Moxie and I done drank 3 beers apiece before I mentioned to him we had no way of paying for what we drunk. He shrugged and reminded me we done drank many times without knowing who was paying. So we ordered another and watched as the ladies set our neighbor's drinks aflame. It was like a wedding in there. People were having so much fun. We gotta come to Aberystown more often, Moxie said, but we never went back through there again. Another round, and Moxie suggested we see what else the town had going for it. I told him we'd be in trouble if we didn't pay and then planned on staying in town. Moxie thought I was right, but gave me no good plan. I told him we could trade in my books for the beer. He told me I liked my books and shouldn't have to part with them. I told him I done read them all 3 and wouldn't mind, and I'd just as soon get some more in Kellytown. He shrugged and said it was my decision, but he'd like to help sell them. We were young, understand, and not so young that we were stupid, but young enough to think trading books for beer was equal and fair. Moxie took my stack and crossed the room and stood next to a table of well-dressed gentlemen and asked if they'd like 3 leather-bound good books if they'd buy us our beers. The men laughed, and Moxie did too, and then he brought the stack to another table, and soon the place was all shouting about the men with the books, but no money for beer. Moxie was pure then, not yet tarnished by his own name, and he went to just about every table in the joint, and by the last couple was plopping himself in chairs along with the Aberystowners and going into a routine that had us all laughing. I could tell we were going to get our drinks paid for, and Moxie gave me a wink, letting me know I'd come up with a good plan. And it worked. Sort of it did. An elderly man seated at the bar called out, "Here, here, I'd like a look at them books." Moxie got to his feet and carried them over to him, and the man brought out his specs and examined their spines. "These are good titles," he said, and I answered, "I know they are." "Haven't seen this one in some 5 years," he said. "I got her an expert," I told him. He looked me over like I might have taken it, as opposed to having read it. I told him my favorite scene and why, and he said, "Gentlemen, let's go out back and take a closer look at these, and if I like them, I'll buy your beers indeed." "Why don't we take a look out front?" Moxie said. And the man smiled and said, "'Cause I'd rather do so in private." Moxie and I followed him through the back door of Leonard's in Aberystown and into the sun-soaked alley behind the bulk of Main Street's storefronts. It was in that alley that we done met Daniel Prouds. The old man asked for the books, and Moxie removed the considerable string that kept them together in a stack and put the string in his pocket. I said the books looked fine in the sunlight, but before the man had a chance to agree, all 3 of us done heard a lady hollering down the alley. We turned and saw she was on the ground, and a man was above her, kicking her in her neck. He had other men with him, and they stood and watched. And Moxie and I could tell it was a whore there on the ground, and something clicked in Moxie, and I still don't know exactly what it was. I said, "Hold on there, Jimmy." But he was already crossing the dirt alley, calling for them to get off the lady. The man turned, and one said, "This ain't your business," and Moxie done knocked him out. Now, I seen some hits, and I seen some poor hits thrown by Moxie himself, but this one was square. This one broke teeth. I was beside Moxie now as the other men turned, and I took him by the arm, telling him we ought to get, that we didn't know nothing about these men. Like I done said before, the outlaw recognizes the outlaw, and I had little doubts these were the black-hearted sort. The one who had been kicking the lady came forth and told Moxie he was going to kill him right here if he didn't get gone, and Moxie asked him to do it. And the man smiled, and I guess he had some real trouble on his hands, because he told Moxie there'd be a duel in an hour at the far empty end of Dunkel Street, instead of shooting Jimmy as he said he would. Moxie said Dunkel Street was a long street. The man told Jimmy there was work being done, a great rectangle of a hole in the road, men putting in a pipe. He told Jimmy they could stand at either end. It looks something like a grave, he said, which ought to make your trip all the faster. That's very kind of you, Moxie said. I try to be kind, the man answered. And let me introduce myself, the man said. I'm Daniel Prouds. I think it important you know the name of the man who kills you. Moxie held his gaze cold and said, My name is James Moxie. In return. Oh, this man Prouds was the classic pig-shit-eating gentleman outlaw. He wore the watch chain and purple vest and fine-pressed pink shirt beneath. He had a black mustache and black hair that came out from under his old white hat. White gloves stained with the struggle he'd had with the lady. Black boots that shone in the sunlight. A finer-dressed outlaw would have been hard to find, and almost always them types, the pig-shitters. We best be going, I told Moxie as we left the old man with the loose books and stepped back into the bar. But Moxie wasn't having it, not that day. I done told him. He done never been in a duel, and he said I was right. I asked him, Ain't you worried? And he answered yes. But he weren't having us leaving town, and I started thinking of life alone on the trail. It was a long hour, I say. And in that hour, people talked. Word traveled that two men were going to have a shootout, and one of them was Daniel Prouds, and one of them was an out-of-towner who done stuck his nose in Prouds' business. Moxie told me he needed some time to think. I told him he needed some time to practice. He got up and left me there at the bar, and I guess it was either on the walk he took or right then before it that the idea hit him. The idea that would transcend the trail. I don't know who the locals were rooting for, 'cause Prouds wasn't a liked man about town, but Moxie was in the wrong as far as they could tell. A few knew I'd been riding with the dead man-to-be and treated me as such. A small cat-house custodian named Rinaldo asked if I thought Jimmy had a chance, and I told him I'd be shocked if Moxie didn't win it. And that's how I handled it. I did my part, pretending Moxie was the best unknown gun they'd never seen. But I was full of shudders by then, truth be told, and no longer worried myself over how to pay for the beers we'd drank. Moxie returned just before the hour was up and sat beside me at the bar. People are talking, I said. Uh-huh. They say he's good, Jimmy. Uh-huh. We waited without talking the last 10 minutes of that hour, and I swear it, that the place went respectfully silent when the two of us rose and walked through the tables. It was funereal, it was, and funereal is a word that ought to only be used near death. I asked a man which direction the work was being done on the road. Jimmy told me he knew where it was. You went and saw it? I asked him. Sure I did, he said. Well, I figured that wasn't going to help us any, and we walked the long boardwalk like we would the plank. My heart was ticklish. It was beating so irregular. And I asked Jimmy a couple more times if he was certain before I just shut up, not wanting to mess him up. Make sure I get the side with sun in my eyes, he said. Hell's heaven, I thought. That sure didn't sound like a man who shot a duel before. But Jimmy insisted. There was already a good crowd when we showed up. And I saw some of the people looking at Jimmy and sizing him up, saying, So this is him. I can't tell you if anybody else could see it, but I knew my good friend was scared. I don't think I ever seen him exactly like it before. His eyes were polar white, and he talked in clipped half words. I seen sweat coming down the brim of his hat. He was looking out at that hole in the road, that rectangle that did look like an exaggerated grave after all. Oh, the ominous stuff was out that day. A man that was neither Prouds nor Moxie suddenly called for the men to come forward, and so they did. I weren't in the huddle when the men chose sides, but I can only guess Moxie asked for the side with the sun in his eyes. Much later, he'd tell me it was 'cause it was the only side he could ask for and expect to get it. A third party informed the crowd that since the men would be shooting over a hole in the earth, there'd be no pacing. My heart nearly failed me when they took their places, Prouds on the near side and Moxie on the far with, yes, the sun in his eyes. The well-dressed pig shitter's back was to me, and his suit looked blood purple in the sunlight. Moxie knelt to the dirt, and it appeared that he cleared a stone from under his boot, and when he came up, his face was lit up strong by the sky. I felt sorry his last expression would be so witnessed. But I had something akin to hope, Maybe just the H of it. Anybody could see by their stances that Prouds had done it before. And Jimmy looked like a child, a young fool, about to spread a lady's legs for the first time. Prouds was stiff as stone. The moderator stepped to the center edge of the pipe hole. He looked from Moxie to Prouds and announced that all was ready. Both men held their hands at their sides, fingers out, slightly bent forward. Jimmy's hands looked too far from his holster. I made to say something, to scream it, but the moderator's arm was in the air, and he called it. Draw, before I said it. Prouds moved snake-like, but Moxie only made a fist. There was a shot, a single shot so loud that me and everybody else winced. And when I opened my eyes, I saw Prouds stumbling, his gun still resting useless in his belt, his hands at his chest, red blood spilling out and over his fingers. He turned for a moment, still wobbling, and I got one good look at his face, his eyes like rolling marbles, before he fell forward at last and fell into the hole at his feet. The crowd was startled silent. To a man, and that includes me, everybody turned their heads to Jimmy, who stood there breathing heavy and rocking lightly on the heels of his boots. The moderator didn't know what to say. Nobody did. Jimmy'd performed some kind of magic. Already a rumor spread that Jimmy's hand was so fast, it was like he hadn't drawn at all. It was the only way to relate to what they'd seen. When they replayed the memory and talked to others who did the same, the idea that Moxie actually didn't draw was galvanized by the power of communal witness. And once they refused the idea of his hand being like lightning, it only left magic as an explanation. The right one, it seemed. Suddenly people were talking a lot, and I seen the moderator step toward Moxie, and I ran out there to be sure Jimmy weren't going to jail. But when I got there, the man was only shaking his head, looking at the hand that didn't draw, looking at the cold gun in the holster, and no doubt trying to reconcile it with Prouds' chest exploding deep red all over the pipe. Jimmy didn't say a word. I'd never seen him as cold as I saw him in that moment. "What do you say we skip town?" I asked him. "You got your books?" he asked. "My books, Jimmy. Don't you worry none about my books. Let's us wipe the pig shit from our boots and get the hell's heaven out of Aberystown." Already I noted how people were treating him like a legend. Whatever they seen, they never seen it before. We left the witnesses gaping on the street. By nightfall, all of Aberystown would know Moxie's name. By week's end, most of the trail. And by the next time Jimmy and I took to the trail, everybody in every city was talking about James Moxie and the magic he'd done sent into Daniel Prouds' good suit. On the ride out, I asked Jimmy how he'd done it. He shook his head slowly, side to side, and it was the first time I seen him look himself since agreeing to the duel. "It wasn't magic, Jefferson," he said. "I know it weren't. So what was it?" Jimmy asked me if I remembered the old man looking at my books out back. I said, "Of course I did." He said, "Yeah, well..." Here the words were already smudged to black by smoke's oil and flames. At the Mander's funeral home. Mander sat at his desk and frowned. The diggers were complaining of a figure lurking about the grounds. Manders had just received a delivery he was happy for, when the diggers came in and told him they'd seen a man in and out of the tree trunks bordering the cemetery. Lucas said he might have seen the man up in one of the trees. Manders said that sounded like they were seeing things. "No, boss," Lucas said. "Someone's been around." Manders reminded him it wouldn't be the first time a prowler lurked, and Lucas agreed. But Hank was a bit more shaken. Said he'd heard something fuddling beneath the dirt he was digging for a Mrs. Winifred Jones's casket. Hank said it got to where he stepped out of the hole he was digging, certain as he was that something was about to break free of the dirt. "I thought it was worms at first," he told Manders, "but it'd have to have been 100,000 worms to make the noise it made." Manders said it sounded like they were hearing things, too, but promised to have the grounds checked for groundhogs and prairie dogs later. Even Norman was flustered. The unflappable makeup artist came to Manders after the diggers left and told him he'd heard someone talking in the basement. He was working on Mrs. Jones's lips when he'd heard it.
I don't mean to bother you, Norm said, but I don't much appreciate the diggers lurking about the basement while I'm working. Of course, Manders told him. You just get back to work and let me know if anyone comes bothering you again. When Norm